from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, are we out of the economic woods and on the way to an upturn in the economy? And have we reached the decline and end of this particular recession? Economists, as usual, disagree, but we'll talk about what the evidence shows and what more we need to discover about the economy and where it's going before we can proclaim better times are here and ahead, or continue to see things as being grim. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Last month, U.S. leading indicators rose more than they had in the past 10 months. Are we out of the clutches of the nation's worst recession since the 1930s? Well, some say we are, though on Monday of last week, a seven-member committee of the Business Cycle Dating Committee, which is part of the National Bureau of Economic Research and has been assigning dates of peaks and troughs for every business cycle, could not make a determinative decision on whether the recession had actually ended. With one major dissenter concluding that the recession has ended, the committee decided that to say it is over would be premature. If there has been a real recovery, one must ask, why are there still double-digit unemployment numbers? On Wednesday, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke, testifying before Congress, expressed confidence in an economic recovery, though he also asked lawmakers for a plan to bring down high budget deficits. And on Sunday, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said the economy is growing faster than the White House had anticipated. So where are we economically? We'll take that question up in this opening hour. And joining us from Washington, D.C. by ISDN line is Tamara Keith, who is a business reporter with National Public Radio. Good morning, Tamara.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Sylvia Algaretto, who is a labor economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley and joins us this morning from Oakland. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. We'll also say good morning to David Henderson, who is with us from Monterey. He's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Welcome, David Henderson.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you all aboard. I thought we'd get a picture from Tamara first, and since you've been covering this Goldman story, I wonder if that's an economic indicator. They've got an SEC civil suit that's filed, and there was really no place to go but up, but they really are up, and they're saying that's an economic indicator.
Well, they made a lot of money in the first quarter. They sort of emerged from the financial crisis bigger and better than ever, certainly stronger than most of their competitors. They said that they made more than $3 billion in the first quarter. And largely they say that that is a result of improved economic conditions.
And what do you think? are they just trying to buoy our confidence, or are we really seeing ourselves out of this recession?
Well, certainly things have been getting better. I mean, the last jobs report, although not amazingly stellar on a national level, did show improvement. Of course, in California, the unemployment rate is still very high. But there are signs of thawing, of things returning to normal. So in that respect, I guess we have to say it doesn't feel great yet, but things are better than they were, certainly. A year ago, we were losing 600,000 jobs a month, and it was ugly.
Well, we've lost 8 million jobs plus as a result of this recession. But on the other hand, there have been 162,000 jobs added in March, although 48,000 are just census jobs. I shouldn't say just census jobs, but are related to the census. But gross domestic product has recovered sharply. There's an upturn in economic growth. These are the really good signs that people are emphasizing, aren't they?
Exactly. I just got back from Michigan, which is a state that has been harder hit than just about anywhere else. And even there, folks were talking about how things do seem to be looking up, that there are actually more jobs posted, that there are businesses that are expanding. The thing to understand about all of these economic indicators is that some things get worse, some things get better, and it's all sort of on net. it's the net effect is slight improvement. I will say also on those jobs numbers, another 40,000 of those jobs were temp jobs. So we had almost 50,000 census jobs and 40,000 temp jobs. So the actual number of real jobs, permanent jobs, was not that impressive.
Well, and consumer spending is up.
Well, we feel better, or as some of the retail analysts are trying to convince me, 2-year-old outfits just aren't going to cut it. The fashions have changed. I'm not sure if I 100% buy that, but I think that to some extent, you can only hang out in a bunker and put your money in the mattress for so long. And people have, in fact, started to spend some money.
Talking with Tamara Keith, who's with us from Washington, business reporter for NPR. There's still weakness, however, in the housing and real estate sector, and that certainly is a big factor in terms of trying to determine whether the economy is on the upswing.
Well, and one other thing to note is that currently the housing market is being buoyed, at least to some extent, by the housing tax credit, which expires at the end of this month. People need to get into contract by the end of this month. I mean, it's not clear how much of an effect that is having, but it's certainly part of it. We've been propping up the housing market, believe it or not, one way or another, through interest rates and through the FHA and Fannie and Freddie buying mortgages and through tax credits. It will be interesting to see how the housing market does when it's standing on its own.
How about real income? That's fragile, isn't it?
Well, yeah, indeed it is. Part of the problem is that when people don't have jobs, their income is certainly not going up.
And yet they're, like we say, consumer buying is up.
Well, part of it is that for a very long time, the savings rate had been increasing. This was a sign that people were hunkering down and saving more, spending less. Incomes did not rise in the most recent numbers, but spending did rise, and the spending actually came from savings, they're saying.
Again, we're talking to Tamara Keith, who is with us from Washington, business reporter with National Public Radio. Sylvia Allegretto, also with us, labor economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley. And Sylvia Allegretto, I'm looking at some statements here by different economists. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's, economy.com, says the recession is over. And then Ken Goldstein says, I don't see any sustained recovery because we don't know where the income to sustain it is coming from.
Well, whether there's a recovery or not, like you mentioned at the beginning, it's really an official definition, taking about 9 indicators that the National Bureau of Economic Research looks at. But on the ground, whether you're in recovery or not really depends on what your vantage point is to the economy. So if you're at Goldman Sachs and you just made $3.5 billion over this quarter, you're probably doing pretty good and taking home large bonuses. But if you're one of the 26 million unemployed or underemployed workers, it's not looking so good when we are down 8.2 million jobs over this recession, which has been about 2 years in length, and over that time about 3 million more folks had entered the labor force. So we're really at a jobs deficit of about 11 million jobs. And so until we actually see robust, sustained job growth for those folks, things aren't going to get better, and they're not going to feel as if they're in recovery.
How does the overcoming of the job losses compare to the other two recessions that we've had?
Well, that's a good question, because to put it in perspective, just to look at the numbers, the raw numbers isn't always that informative because the economy is much larger now. But to talk about 2001 recession, in 2001 we lost about 2% of all jobs at the worst point of job loss. Right now, we are at about 6% of total job loss, and in the private sector, we're over 7% of all those jobs have been lost over this recession. So it's a very, very severe jobs deficit that we're looking at.
So even if it looks like we're not in recession or there's economic growth ticking upward, we still have this huge obstacle to overcome with respect to unemployment.
Well, that's what you may hear is definitely what we've seen in the last two recoveries, the 1990 recovery and the 2001 recovery, were followed by jobless recoveries. And that's meaning exactly what you said. When the Bureau says that we're actually in economic recovery and output is up and the other indicators are up, it's been the case that following those designated times, the labor force actually continued to shed jobs as if in recovery for quite some time. The 2001 recession was only 8 months long, but it was ended officially in November of 2001. But we continued to lose jobs until mid-2003. And so if we, in fact, are looking at a jobless recovery, and I think we are, and that on top of the fact that we've had such a lengthy downturn, 2 years, which is really long compared to the last two that were only 8 months long, I mean, we're going to be in this situation for a very, very long time, and we're going to see, as has been forecast, extremely high unemployment rates for years to come.
How about the effect of deficits on this from your perspective? I mean, we've extended unemployment payments, COBRA, food stamps, all as a result, one might argue, or to a great extent, a result of the unemployment.
That's right. I mean, there's two things about the deficit. I mean, one is that it's much higher this year because of the fact we are in such a severe recession. As you've pointed out, we have to spend money countercyclically. I mean, we hope and we do have, and it's good that we have during very hard times, we have spending that kicks in. Automatic stabilizers such as unemployment. Unemployment's good because, it keeps people afloat. It keeps families afloat. And it also is a very good stimulus for the economy. As far as the deficit is concerned, it's certainly a problem, and certainly a problem in the long run, and something that we need to fix. And I'll say two things about it. One is this is not really the time to worry about it. We have to first get out of this problem. To fix the deficit, you need to fix the jobs problem, get people back to work, get businesses collecting money again, and getting us on solid footing. The second thing is, in the long term, the part of the deficit problem is a health care problem. And so we really have to fix, spiraling out of control health care costs before we can probably bring the deficit down.
Sylvia Allegretto, again, is a labor economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley. She's with us from Oakland. David Henderson is with us from Monterey. He's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And David, there was a cover story that came out just last week, Newsweek, you might have seen it, by David Gross, where he said, let's not look at the economy through such concern, because maybe we have large deficit, maybe there's a housing crisis, but he highlights such things as the Dow Jones being up, auto sales being up, the dollar gaining. In fact, he says the economy is definitely growing, and we've got all this resilience, Silicon Valley showing it can continue to be inventive. We should be pretty hopeful.
I'm somewhat hopeful. The analogy I like to use is one that my late colleague at Hoover, Milton Friedman, used. Think of the economy as the long stem of a violin, and you pull a string, and the further you pull it up, the more it goes back, the bigger distance it goes back to where it started. And I think the economy is like that. The bigger the fall, the larger the potential rise, because there are all these, and now to get past the analogy to what's really going on in the economics, there are all these unemployed resources out there dying to be employed, and so that will happen. The question is how quickly it will happen. There are some good signs. The Dow, as you mentioned, is one. The growth in income, the growth in GDP is another. One thing that I think is, there's a number of factors slowing down this recovery. So if we focus on jobs, there are two major things there that have slowed down job growth. One actually is, ironically, unemployment insurance. Because unemployment insurance pays people to be unemployed. And when you pay people to do more of something, they do more of it. And what happens is it's not the story that people are lazy. That might be a certain segment. It's the story that people are rational. So if they're looking at a job that is not the ideal one they want, and it only pays after tax $3 or $4 more dollars an hour than they can get on unemployment insurance, they're going to be pickier. And so, in fact, I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal, a letter preparing for this interview that appeared yesterday, and this guy who was criticizing the journal editors for quoting my encyclopedia, an article by Larry Summers, laying this out, and he says, this is heartless, this is discompassionate, and then about a couple of sentences later, he says, I didn't put myself through college in order to be a clerk at the convenience store or a greeter at Walmart. In other words, he's kind of admitting our point, that if there were no unemployment insurance, or if they hadn't been extended for up to 99 weeks, which is European level, there would be people out there being greeters at Walmarts or whatever until they get, or and my guess is he'd do a little better than that, but until they get that ideal job. And so that's one of the things that slowed it down. The other thing is the minimum wage went up last July. It was scheduled to go up, and yes, it did. And the problem there, of course, is we actually had deflation last year. And so in real terms, the minimum wage went up by double digits, double-digit percent. And that was really bad timing. And so the least skilled people get priced out of work, as the late economist Paul Samuelson said when he's talking about an increase, proposed increase to $2 an hour in 1970. What good does it do an unskilled black youth to know that if he gets a job, he can be paid $2 an hour, when the fact that he must be paid $2 an hour is what prevents him from getting a job?
Well, if we're looking at unemployment, we're seeing more blacks unemployed. We're seeing more women out of work as well. I mean, there are certain sectors of the population that are obviously having greater impact as a result of this economy.
Oh, by the way, it's men. It's a man session. It's the new term, because, in fact, men have lost way more jobs than women in this one, and that's unusual.
You're not talking just about black men. You're talking about men, period.
Men, period, right.
Yeah. Well, I want to bring Robert Herbst into this discussion briefly. He's airline analyst and founder of AirlinesFinancials.com, because, as you well know, airplanes are closed. Airports are closed all across Europe, and officials have been hopeful that air travel would resume on Sunday or possibly Monday, but Iceland's volcano is a bit, shall we say, unpredictable, to put it mildly. I wanted to find out from you, Robert Herbst. Let me say good morning to you first. Welcome to the program.
Good morning to you.
Just what we're talking about the economy here, and the airlines are losing about $21 million a day. All these European airports are closed. How do you see this affecting the economy, the global economy, or American economy specifically?
Well, I think it'll have some impact here on the U.S. economy, but Europe is going to feel it much more than we will. And the uncertainty of the future is the big problem. We don't know how long this is going to go on for, and this volcano can keep erupting for who knows how long, which will basically shut down the, or at least make it unpredictable what kind of air traffic they can control over the European countries.
But we're reading that these are the biggest losses since 9/11, and I mean, that's got to have a significant impact.
Well, they're the biggest losses in Europe, but they're not the biggest losses in the United States by even any stretch of the imagination.
No, $21 million a day certainly doesn't equal what we saw in the United States after 9/11. I was talking
about.
No. Yeah. But things are changing also in the airline industry. I mean, there's talk now of United doing another merger, and how do you see that in the perspective of, well, where the economy's going?
Well, United and US Air have been merging with someone, I think, about every 9 months for the last 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, it may happen this time. It's really hard to say. I think there needs to be consolidation in the airline industry. So, for me, at least in my opinion, it would be a positive for the industry if they did get together.
Well, we thank you for joining us, and we'll obviously hope that things will move forward as far as what's going on in Europe, because it's been pretty dreadful. Robert Herbst, again, with us from St. Louis, airline analyst and founder of AirlineFinancials.com. And before I open up the phone lines and invite those of you listening to comment on the economy or to raise questions you might have, I want to go back to Tamara O'Keefe, who's with us only for this first half hour, and talk a little bit about, with you, Tamara, the fact Detroit was mentioned. And when you look in Detroit, you said you were in Michigan, may see some movement or ticking upward. But you look at certain places in the United States, here in the Central Valley in California. I was reading an article that was talking about Twinsburg, Ohio, and Clark County, Nevada. Things do look pretty bleak in certain areas as opposed to other areas. So you have to be, to some extent, geographically minded when you're assessing the economy.
Well, and I will say that although the folks in Detroit are saying that things are ticking up, I mean, you're ticking up from really, really bad. I mean, I will say that it was downright depressing. And I spoke with folks who have been desperately searching for work for 2 years, and who are trying to go through retraining, and it's just not working.
Auto sales may be up because of Toyota, as far as GM and Ford are concerned.
And those incredible interest rates to try to compensate for the recalls. Things are improving a little bit, but you're right that there are pockets all over the country where things are incredibly bad. I mean, in Nevada, the housing market has not seen any signs of really bottoming or improving. It's just been dismal. Obviously, Central California, even when it's good in California, in Central California, there's a lot of hardship. And that you know, our nation's economy is not a monolith.
And when you talk about auto sales being up, you compare, say, furniture sales or appliance sales, and you don't see that kind of movement up like you do with autos.
Well, you know, it sort of depends month to month. I think actually, oddly enough, furniture sales may have been up slightly last month. But we are in sort of that fit and start stage where something starts to look good and then it turns back around again, or it's just a really tough time, which I think is why the Bureau is reluctant to call the recession over.
Well, you had mentioned interest rates, and Ben Bernanke has pledged to keep the rates low for what he described as an extended period of time. But there's also some concern and anxiety about federal low rates creating a bubble in stocks and bonds and commodities. How do you see that?
Well, watching the Fed is a little bit, they make little tiny movements. They change one word and people jump up and down. But I will say that mortgage interest rates, although the Fed has pledged to keep the banking rates low, the mortgage interest rates have risen slightly. And that's one of those rates that affects people, you know, in the heartland, as it were.
David Henderson, you want to do a little prognosticating here?
Well, I think I'll go back to the violin example. I think things will get better. We'll have some kind of recovery. It'll be slower than it would have been without those things I mentioned. I think the health care reform, so-called reform, will actually slow things down because of the uncertainty it creates. But still, you know, as Adam Smith said, there's much ruin in a nation. So you can have a whole lot of things going wrong, but a whole lot of things also go right. So my prediction is that a year from now, GDP will be higher in real terms, and the unemployment rate will be slightly lower in as a percent of the labor force.
Sylvia Allegretto, you want to go on record here?
Well, again, I mean, I think that two things. One is that it was, you know, it's absurd to blame unemployment insurance on those who are unemployed when the fact is we are creating no jobs in the economy. Until we see jobs pick up, we're not going to have a recovery on Main Street. And also the minimum wage. I mean, for 10 years, the minimum wage didn't increase. For 10 whole years, it didn't increase. It was at a historic low. So to think that somehow the minimum wage is to blame for this downturn is, again, absurd. What we had was an $8 trillion housing bubble, and the financial sector that didn't see it and that didn't know it was there, and the improprieties in the financial sector that brought down a whole economy. And so we really need to get some proper regulation in place, proper oversight, and proper protection for average Americans to make sure that they aren't taking, as they are now, the brunt of this extremely serious downturn.
All right, let me invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. I have to say goodbye to Tamara Keith, unfortunately, but Tamara, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael.
Tamara Keith, business reporter for National Public Radio. And you can join us now if you have questions or comments about the economy. Do you think we're out of the recession? Are you hopeful about this recovery, or are you skeptical? Let's hear from you. And if you have questions, we welcome you as well. Our toll-free number available now, 866-733-6786. Again, you can call us from anywhere. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website. Visit kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke last week told Congress that the nation is pulling out of the recession, that recovery will last, and three straight months of retail sales gains have brightened this country's economic outlook. But unemployment, particularly here in California, remains quite high, and the question is the recession over? And if so, what does that mean for those who are struggling to find work and to keep their homes? We were joined earlier by Tamara Keith, business reporter, who spent the first half hour with us for National Public Radio, and Robert Hurst, who is an airline analyst and founder of AirlineFinancials.com. And spending the hour with us is David Henderson, research fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, and Sylvia Allegretto, labor economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Unemployment at UC Berkeley. Let's go right to your calls. And David, we begin with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to ask about the jobs that were lost and maybe why they're not coming back so fast. I mean, a bunch of banks went out of business, and that affected the housing industry. You know, mortgage brokers. Okay, so that's where a lot of the jobs are. But and so maybe when they come back, the jobs will too. But also, are we also not seeing the jobs coming back because, in terms of the labor market, we're not the cheap labor, because that's abroad, and also we're not the smartest labor because that's also abroad?
Sylvia Allegretto.
Well, I think we have some of the most productive workers in the world, and right now that's kind of part of the problem. Productivity is increased greatly, meaning that the same amount of workers are producing the output. So we have to actually have GDP that's at much higher than we have right now, somewhere over 5%, before we actually start to add jobs. The other thing is work hours are way down. So those who actually kept their jobs and were kept on as employees have seen their hours cut. So we're going to see employers first to start to increase hours of work before they're going to start to increase permanent employees. And we're seeing this in the few jobs that have been created so far this year, that a lot of them have been in employment services and temporary help, because firms are not sure if we're on very solid footing. So before they start investing in a permanent workforce, they're going to increase hours and adjust hours, and also have a temporary labor force.
I think also may look at the question that the caller is raising in terms of outsourcing. How do you see that affecting the job market?
Well, we're never really sure how that's working out. We don't have a lot of good data on that. But over the long term, we certainly know that outsourcing to other countries and such is part of the problem, and we are competing on a world stage. But right now, in the short run, the problem more is that we don't have enough demand. We don't have enough confidence in that demand for firms to start hiring.
Well, David Henderson, there are those who, I want to get your response, but I was just going to say there are also those who opine that what is affecting the job market is the fact that many of the businesses are looking to turn over a quick profit, and to do that, in terms of bottom line, you lay off people. It doesn't necessarily help the company. In fact, in many cases, it kind of poisons morale, but there it is.
Well, that depends on the company. I want to go back to this cheap labor point. I think that the caller, David, made a good point, and it's not about us versus foreign. It's just that one thing, it gets back to this unemployment insurance point. And by the way, Sylvia really radically misstated what I said. I didn't blame unemployment on the unemployed. I blamed some of it on unemployment insurance. That's all I did. But people have what's called a reservation wage, the wage they're willing to accept. And the higher unemployment insurance is, the longer the duration, the more picky they are about a job. So that slows down an adjustment to make labor slightly cheaper. Not cheap like in China, but 5% cheaper, which would price a number of people back into the labor market.
Let me bring more of our calls. Tony, good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, Tony, are you there?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I want to tell you what my experience has been, because I think it might give a clue as to why, at least one of the factors that is preventing more jobs from coming onto the market, and that is that I work for a big company, and when this whole thing started, they started laying off people like crazy. My work has been more or less doubled, and I think that they did this not because the business went down so much. Number of clients went down so much. But rather that if they double my work, make me do overtime, that's still cheaper than hiring somebody to whom they have to pay benefits. And so I think they're using the company I work for, and you can understand why I won't tell you what company it is, and other companies are doing this because it's an opportunity to, as they say, create a rise in productivity without having to pay more benefits. So they improve their bottom line just by doing that. So that's been my experience, and I think that is at least one factor.
Okay, Tony, thank you for bringing that up. David Henderson, want to respond to Tony's remarks?
I think that what Tony's saying could be going on, but the thing then to explain is why they didn't do this 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, because all those factors were still there. He's pointing to a very good point that to some extent, especially health insurance benefits are a fixed cost. In other words, they aren't going to pay higher health insurance benefits for him if he's working 60 hours a week versus 40 hours a week. And so they can leverage that, as he says. Then the question, though, to address is why they didn't do that 3 or 4 years ago. They don't need excuses. They can do this. And so I don't think that's a key thing that's going on here. I think really what's going on, and take his case, is that per hour, I don't know exactly how he's paid, but per hour he might actually be being paid less. And what you generally see happen in a recession that gets us out of a recession is real wages falling to then price people back into the labor market. So even though he feels bad about it, the alternative might have been that he would have lost his job if they didn't have this option. My daughter, who's 25, I've told her, you know, don't go to your employer right now and try to get a wage increase. Not good timing. You got a job. It's full time. You'd like a little higher wage. You think you're really productive. You are. But this isn't exactly the time to do it.
A couple of emails have come in here that I just want to go to quickly. One is from Paul, who says that I mentioned a couple times that airline losses in Europe have been $20 million a day since the volcano first erupted. Actually, I said $21 million a day is the figure of U.S. losses, airline losses. And he's correcting me here, though the correction is not necessary, saying the correct amount is actually $200 million a day, and that's certainly true in Europe. As of Sunday, total losses exceeded $1 billion. Matt from Rockridge asks you, David Henderson, have you any actual empirical evidence, as opposed to armchair psychology, is the way he phrases it, to support the view that the extension of unemployment benefits is having a negative effect on the growth of GDP?
Yeah, by the way, it's armchair economics, just to get it right. And yes, I do have evidence. Two economists at Northwestern, their names aren't, they're not coming to immediately, but they studied duration, extending duration, and they find that there's a huge increase in the number of people getting work when they're in the last couple of weeks of their benefits. So this just extends it. The other, quote, armchair psychologists, unquote, who came to this conclusion are the people at the Federal Reserve Board. In their January minutes, they said that they think about 1 percentage point of the unemployment we have now is due to this extension of benefits.
And you say what, Sylvia Allegretto?
Well, I'd say the extension of benefits has actually helped keep the economy afloat. We know that it's one of the most effective stimuluses. You get about $1.63 for every dollar spent in unemployment back into the economy. And the reason that we see these spikes in unemployment is because, yeah, once people's unemployment insurance is going to run out, sure, they're going to go out and try to take any job they can. But the fact is we want people to try to match up their skills with the best job that they can match to in the economy, to get very qualified and skilled people to take lower skilled and less skilled jobs is just taking them from other people who would match to those jobs. So one of the effects of unemployment insurance is to keep people afloat, keep the economy afloat, and to give people time to hopefully match their skills with the appropriate job.
I've actually heard people ask if unemployment insurance creates a stimulus, why not use stimulus money instead of unemployment insurance?
Well, that's a good question, because we do know these people need the money. I mean, the average unemployment check is about a third of someone's typical wage. So they're not getting rich off of this. It's not a pleasant situation when you are on unemployment and you're having to really cut things out of your budget that your family needs, such as schooling and health care and such. But it helps keep you afloat, and it absolutely is one of the most effective stimulus that we have out there. And if we would pull all of the unemployment insurance money out of the economy, things would have been much, much worse, and the unemployment rate now would be a lot higher.
Well,
yeah, I think it'd be lower.
Go ahead, David Henderson.
Yeah, I think it'd be lower. And the thing is, Sylvie makes a good point about the matching, and I made that point. I'm saying that that's an individual decision, and there's no externality there. There's no thing not taken account of by the person getting the job, some other benefit to someone else. It's the benefit to that person. So if you have the government subsidize people for looking, they'll look too long.
Here's Carol, who raises a question that I think is worth at least considering, and she says, how can anyone possibly say we're going out of the recession when every city, state, school district, et cetera, is near bankruptcy?
Well, that's because of you know, the teachers union and the fact that the government runs it. And so that's a separate issue. We could have the school system go into bankruptcy and have just this incredible recovery. I mean, granted, there's some connection. It's obvious that, I think, as Sylvia pointed out, that if you have a growing economy, it throws off more tax revenues, and so the cities and states aren't in as bad a shape. But the point is that that's just a sectoral issue. It's a sectoral issue influenced by the overall economy. But you know, that's because, I mean, we essentially have a socialist system in education.
Want to say something here, Sylvia?
Well, again, the schools are not going broke because of the teachers' unions. The localities and state governments are broke because of the $8 trillion housing bubble that burst and the financial sector that put us in this mess. And so, you know, what we really need is we need actually increased federal spending right now to state and government, to state governments and locales. Because that's what we, even though it's going to increase the deficit, we have to take care of the problem now to take care of the problem in the future. What we do know is there is a lot of economic hurt and a lot of economic insecurity that needs to be fixed. And these, like the California here with a 12.6% unemployment that nobody even blinks at anymore.
Here are some more email opinions that I want to read. Tim writes, isn't the problem that the economy was debased and that the ballooning of the financial sector and players like Goldman Sachs was a key aspect of the problem of value being drained out of the real economy? If so, how in the world does Goldman's record profits last quarter indicate that the problem is solved? Seems to me the opposite is true. Goldman's riches, in contrast with the continuing lack of jobs, especially in the real economy, manufacturing, indicates to me that in real terms, there's little real and sustainable improvement. I'll feel better when the financial sector's destructive role is addressed and we find some way to restore the real economy. And another listener, Tony, writes, why the economy will enter another recession in 2011. One thing we learned from Keynes, don't raise taxes during a recession. The new health care bill imposes many new taxes, especially on small businesses, the engines of job creation, and the expiration of the Bush tax cuts counts as a tax increase. Of course, this could have been partially mitigated if the funds in the economic stimulus bill had actually been spent rapidly. Last time I checked at ProPublica.com, about half the funds remained unspent. Government spending stimulates the economy. Promised future government spending does not. Well, Sylvia Allegretto gets right to the core of the health care question. How's this going to affect?
Well, I think first of all, it's wrong to say that it's going to hurt small businesses. Most small businesses are going to be exempt or get tax breaks to help pay for the health care of their employees. And the problem right now is that the government spending has been too little, too late. It was the fact that when this happened, when the economy really fell off the cliff well over a year, year and a half ago, the stimulus package that went way too much towards tax breaks and other incentives for businesses should have been directly spent to put workers to work. And that would have been much more effective and much more effective to stimulate the economy and to get us out of this mess. The fact is, when you give tax breaks to businesses, it can be a good thing, especially hiring tax breaks. But right now, the problem is demand. If you don't have customers, you're not going to be able to sell product.
David Henderson.
I think that actually I've never been one to hesitate at criticizing Goldman. I thought that, you know, Paulson shouldn't have even been allowed in on the decision to bail out the people like AIG who then, you know, and that saved Goldman Sachs' bacon. And his adult kids had $100 million in net worth in Goldman. And so I think he had a clear cut conflict of interest. Having said that, my impression about this Goldman situation is that they were actually one of the few who didn't bet on the bubble and did well. And I'm wondering if they're being penalized because of that, because they didn't do the stupid things some of the others did. And this whole, you know, recent thing, the civil suit, is strange to me because they're being nailed for putting together a package on which they themselves took a loss. So as the Wall Street Journal said, so Goldman conspired to defraud itself? It just makes no sense.
Well, here's a question from a listener who also, I think, wants some clarity about something else that you said earlier, David Henderson.
Sure.
This is Devin, who says, Is your guest suggesting that society is better off with highly trained engineers working as Walmart clerks? Countless studies show that once individuals take a job at a much lower wage for more than a few months, thus creating a significant gap in their resume, they are very unlikely to return to work at anything close to their original wage or in a job requiring a comparable set of skills to what they previously were employed at. He seems to be suggesting that forcing individuals with advanced skill sets to let those skills go to waste is somehow good for society. Maybe he can better explain how society benefits from aerospace engineers working as Walmart clerks while we offshore technical jobs overseas.
Okay, first of all, I'm not advocating the use of force. I'm advocating eliminating or reducing the use of force. I'm not saying anyone should be forced in any job. I believe in free labor markets. Second, to the extent that person is right, people can take account of that. So someone who says, hey, I'm better off sitting around waiting for a better job than going out and getting that temporary job, that person can take account of that. But either way, there's a gap in the resume. One says you worked at Walmart. The other says you're unemployed. I don't know which is worse. It's not obvious to me that working at Walmart and showing that you're willing to stay in the employed labor force is worse than sitting at home.
Well, I think we have a caller on point here. Craig, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. There's so much that's been said. It's kind of hard to point to one thing. I'm a holder of a teaching credential and a master's degree, and I'm unemployed. And frankly, I listen to these comments about unemployment insurance, and I find myself getting extremely angry. I would love to have a job, any job. But the fact of the matter is, when someone comes into Walmart with my resume, they say, why are you here? And I say, well, I need a job. Well, why this job? Because I need to pay my bills. I need to pay my mortgage. I need to put food on the table. I need to help my kids. And they say, well, I'm sorry. We know you're going to be gone in 6 months because something better will come along.
Or they tell you you're overqualified, right?
Exactly. I'm overqualified. But further, the indicators that people are using to say that our economy is better and better are indicators that really say that the economy is better for people who are who come from a certain segment of the economy. Not everybody holds stocks and bonds in their portfolio, and so Dow Jones Industrial averages don't say what's happening for those people who don't own stocks and bonds. And frankly, it's the wealthy that are getting the bounce back right now. It's not the middle class.
I would agree with Craig about the stocks and bonds. And what I would
David Henderson.
For Craig is not to go and try to get a job at Walmart for the reasons he very well laid out, but rather try to get a job as a tutor. You know, put up your shingle somewhere, put up the ads in the Safeways and so on, and those can pay pretty well. So that would be my suggestion to him.
You want to give your suggestions or thoughts on this, Sylvia Allegretto?
Well, the problem is we have millions of people like the caller. So that trying to be a tutor or to work on your own, be self-employed, which a lot of people do try to do, is really not the answer. I mean, we need, some serious job creation. If we let this economy just kind of work its way through this, and again, if you look at 2001, the best of times in the six-year expansion that followed the 2001 recession, we created, on average, 160,000 jobs a month. That is really terrible. The Great American Jobs Machine has not only faltered during times like now when we're in recession, but it actually hasn't been doing very well even in expansion. So we can't let this just go on its own, I don't think, because it's going to be, again, you'll see the Goldman Sachs with billions in profits. You'll see the Wall Street and the Dow Jones. It's up 40% over this year. But for the average person on Main Street, this is not going to get better anytime soon.
Sylvia, yesterday we did our first hour about the new Pew Research study, which says that Americans have less trust in their government and government providing solutions than perhaps ever before. And yet, I know you have come out and advocated, and I think many people feel this way, that the government should take a stronger role in providing jobs for the infrastructure, to build roads and bridges and potholes, take care of potholes, that sort of thing, like the WPA, like Roosevelt did.
Yeah, I believe that when this first happened, I believe it now. How many times do we have to turn on the news here in California and see a news camera by some big pothole and 20 cars pulled over to the side with flat tires? I mean, we've actually let this infrastructure in this, not just in California, but all across the country, crumble for the last 50 to the 100 years. It would be a good investment. It's an investment that would actually make our economy grow better and faster in the future. So if we spent those money smartly, it would help now and in the future. But it's something that's not getting much talk these days. There's not much push for such programs, even though about a year or so ago there was, and it's kind of perplexing that things have gotten so bad. Again, the California economy, the unemployment rate is 12.6%, the highest post-World War II percentage that we've ever seen, and no one even really blinks an eye at it anymore. That's incredible. I mean, is this our new normal? This is going to be just incredibly terrible, especially now that we're trying to balance the budget again. California is going to lay off more workers. They might impose more furloughs. It's going to create another round of anti-stimulus that is working against the federal stimulus dollars that are in this state, and it's very possible that unemployment is going to continue to increase.
Let me go to more calls, and we'll go next to Melissa. Melissa, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have to say that I find your male guest offensive and ignorant. This recession has been going on since the 70s. My father was the first engineer. He and all engineers that were 50, they were laid off in the 70s. They were highly professional. They had golden parachutes, and that pension was stolen by companies. They never got their jobs back. I'm 54. When I was in my mid-40s in executive management, I was laid off. And all my 401k, that's long gone. My unemployment benefits, long gone. If I get a job, it's a temporary job if I'm lucky and I'm one of the first layoffs. I'm told I'm overqualified for everything. Out of my 15 best friends, 14 have left the state because they couldn't find work. If I go to any kind of a networking event, I'm one of the youngest people there. We have to deal with ageism. We have to deal with the fact that I'm being told I'm overqualified. I agree with your previous callers. Apparently for eating and breathing. He thinks we can find a job at Walmart. He's wrong. He thinks we can find a job anywhere. We can't. People look at our salary. They look at our background. We can lie about it, but they'll find out. And then they get really angry at us because we make more than the people who are hiring us. It is just insane. We haven't had health care. No one wants to pay us health care, although we paid into Blue Cross Blue Shield for years without using it. How are we going to address the real problem here, which is that most of the people I know don't even figure into your statistics because we fell out years ago.
All right, first of all, I said nothing offensive. If you're offended, Melissa, that is your issue. I didn't say anything offensive. I said things you disagreed with, and I don't like you using that kind of charge against me. Second, the point is that in any recovery, the way it happens is real wages adjust downward and price people back into the market, or aggregate demand goes up. What we have focused on this whole hour, because I didn't get any questions that allowed me to go there, is how you get aggregate demand up. The wrong way to do it is with fiscal policy, is with government spending. When government spends its own money, it spends it on many useless things. Sylvia and I can both agree that potholes should be filled, but notice that this government that she puts a lot of trust in didn't do it. The best way to increase aggregate demand is to have monetary policy, is to raise the growth rate of the money supply, and then at least people are spending money on the things they want to spend it on, not on some government priority.
Let me get a response from Sylvia Allegretto.
Well, I would just like to continue with what Melissa said, and she's really right. We're really talking about a problem in the economy that started some 30 years ago. And, over the past three decades, the top 1% of income owners have captured 56% of the income growth. It is the case that the rich are getting richer. And David keeps talking about wages adjusting and falling wages for people, and we know that's happening. Workers are now getting paid much less today than they were a year or two ago. And for a lot of male workers, the average male worker, they're getting paid less today than they were 30 years ago. So one of the biggest problems, the longer-term problems, is the increase in inequality and the fact that the rich are getting richer. It's not a figment of our imagination. The growth in income and the policies, a lot of the government policies and regulations have favored the rich to make the income growth flow not across broadly based increases for everyone, or a rising tide lifting all boats type of thing that I think we would all like to see. I mean, we have hard workers here in America, but what we're seeing is that the rich are getting richer, and income growth is flowing more and more to those at the top. And we're seeing that today with the insane, 3.5 billion dollar profits of Goldman Sachs.
Let me get Gregory on quickly here. Gregory, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah, Goldman Sachs, I think, is the example. But can we focus the question on the issue of casino banking versus the email writer said, the real economy? I don't see how anybody can diagnose the condition of our economy as long as the casino banking is included. My feeling is that casino banking ought to just be outlawed, and the firewalls have to be put up so that they're only done by companies calling themselves casino banks, and that real banking, real investment, and real business and real stocks has to be done by completely separate institutions.
Well, on that note of casino banking, we're going to have to conclude. We've come to the end of the hour.
Michael, I need to go. I'm going to say goodbye.
Well, I thank you. David Henderson again with us for the hour, research fellow with Hoover Institution and associate professor of economics at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Thanks to Sylvia Allegretto, also labor economist with the Institute for Research, also, I should say, with us for this hour on labor and employment at UC Berkeley. And our thanks to Tamara Keith, our own business reporter for National Public Radio. And we also spoke with Robert Herbst, who is airline analyst and founder of AirlineFinancials.com. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Always like to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to suggest or recommend or respond to, you can always call our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.